Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. This is completely my comfort zone today, and for that reason, Lockie's here as well. You all right, Lockie?
Yeah, good. Yeah, it's been fun.
World War One nerding today, right up our alley. Who's with us?
We got Dr. Nick Lloyd with us. He's here to introduce his new book, The Western Front. He himself is a reader in military and imperial history in the Defence Studies Department at King's College London.
Okay, right. So you are in a room with two nerds of your own ilk. Let's just crack on because we've got so many questions. First of all, let's cover the book and what it is and who's it for, because this is a big book. It arrived and I was like, wow, this is chunky. Lockie's holding it up. Who did you write it for? Is this aimed at the likes of Lockie and I, or is this aimed at a general reader? Is this sort of trying to bring World War One to a wider audience?
Yeah, I mean, it's a popular history book, so it's aimed at, you know, it's aimed as wide an audience as possible, really. I think, you know, I wrote the book I wanted to read, really, so I was fortunate that I could do what I wanted to do, so I wrote big narrative history. I wanted to get all the key characters in there and I want to do the whole thing. So I wrote the book I wanted to write and I wrote it essentially for me. But I think, you know, I think people who are broadly familiar with the war might get a lot out of it. I think people who have known nothing about the war will hopefully be able to follow it along as they go through. But I think for people who obviously, like yourselves, are experts in it, I think it does offer something slightly different to perhaps what we've got at the moment.
What would you say makes it different in that way? If this is going to make the claim to be the definitive book on the Western Front, which, you know, hopefully we are, what makes it that?
That's the thing, isn't it? Your publishers are loving this. We've got the press release as well, and they're saying, like, this is the definitive now Western Front book. Why is that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think obviously the publisher really wants to see it do as well as it can for obvious reasons. But I think there are a number of reasons why the book, these claims are made. It covers all the sides. So it covers the French, it covers the Germans, the British, and of course the Americans. So you have a sort of comprehensive view of the war that, that I think is quite different from certainly the Anglo-centric view of the war that we're so used to, and which incorporates the entirety of the strategy and the politics and all that kind of thing. So I think for a lot of readers, a lot of it will be quite unfamiliar. You follow the French and Germans initially, and then the British come in a bit more, and then, you know, you get the Americans. So you have the whole, you know, you have the whole sort of sweep of it, really. And that was really what I wanted to do and what I found most interesting.
I have to ask, so what is, for that reason, you've had to work in a, I'm on the wrong question, let me go back. To that end, what battle or element do you think you've brought the biggest new, or the biggest amount of change to? So what part of the war will we see differently as a result of reading this?
I think you'll see the whole thing. So I don't necessarily think it's one individual battle that has a new spin. I think it's the entirety of the project and the whole span of the war and how the Allies get it together by 1918 and win. So I think for a lot of people, it's going to be the French. It's going to be certainly the early days of the French army and their struggles that most of us don't really have a lot of a kind of perspective on. The French are sort of the other on the Western Front, so this incorporates that whole story.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that. I'm, before being a historian, I was a linguist. I was a languages graduate, my first degree, and so I appreciate the French coming in. But that's not the only foreign language that's there. You've got German sources. I think there was even a Portuguese language source in there as well. What was it like working in all those different languages?
Yeah, it takes time. It takes time. It's the most difficult thing. The German stuff is the worst I found. Well, not the worst, the most time consuming to go through the stuff and to try and find the anecdotes and the quotes that I wanted. So that takes the time. The French is slightly easier for me. But I think it takes the time and I mean, the British stuff is easy. It goes really quickly. I can do the British, and the Americans is really easy to write, but it's the French and the Germans that I really had to emphasize and put a lot of time in to give them that sort of that presence to be able to tell their story. So, you know, now I'm writing about the Eastern Front, so I've got, you know, this is like much more difficult. So we've got obviously Russian, Serbian, Italian, German, and ironically on the Eastern Front, German is the easiest for me, but everything else is. So yeah, that was really key, and I enjoyed doing it, and I enjoyed doing the learning about certainly the French army and their early struggles and the way they developed. I found that fascinating. And you know, you've always got the, because I think one of the crucial things about the book is you follow the characters and you see what they're trying to do, you see the advances they try to make, and then you then see what the Germans are doing to respond. So you have that constant sort of back and forth. And I think that's probably what's, I don't say unique, but a big strength of the book is that you see how things evolve. And, you know, you're cheering on at times, you're cheering on the Allies, they're able to do this. And then you see what the Germans do and you think, oh, what are they going to do now? And that dichotomy, J.F.C. Fuller called it the constant tactical factor, which, you know, which is that crucial part of warfare that we often forget. So, you know, I found that fascinating. But yeah, in terms of the language stuff took the most time. That was the most challenging bit, and expensive, getting all properly then, you know, all the sections I wanted then properly translated. So it's time and money, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it, especially drifting into Eastern Europe, and you know, for two more books coming up, I think it's bold. I mean, there was one translation I've brought out my massive German dictionary for it, because I you know, I wasn't sure about it. And that was the Verdun offensive has the code name Gericht. And the way you've translated that is place of execution. I thought that was a pretty unorthodox translation of it. I think I've seen it done as court of justice. I think that's Holger Herwig's one. Jankowski's gone with judgment. Does it ever kind of worry you with all these kind of languages that other people are going to interpret things differently?
Oh yeah, no, of course. I think, you know, you get into that and you, I think if people are, you know, I think people can go back and retranslate it. They can find what I've translated, of course, and can essentially assess how accurate it is. So I think that's absolutely fine. That's why all the footnotes are there, so they can look at it. I think place of execution just sounds so dramatic. And, you know, once I saw that, I thought, yeah, that's how I like it. So again, it's just the sort of, for me, it was something that's, I guess about the drama and about the kind of intensity and the horror of it that I really liked. So, you know, you try and add that level of tension and drama to it to keep the reader interested and to keep the, just to remind them of how enormous all this is and how horrible it is.
This book is big, and necessarily so. The Western Front is a huge topic. How did you pick what not to pick in? So if we give the reader an example, the listener an example, sorry, because they haven't read it yet. We hope they all will. The British infantry assault on the 1st of July 1916 is covered in a couple of pages. Do you think it's fair to say that this is not the book to pick up if you want to look at the individual soldier's experience?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think there are elements of that within the book, but the focus is not on the individual soldier in the trench. It's on the generals, and it's on that higher strategic and operational level, how the politicians and generals worked or didn't work together, how they tried to deal with the problems they encountered on the Western Front. So I think I try to bring out sort of the elements of the battlefields and roughly what they might have looked like, but the concentration is on those characters and their struggles as they go through and try and work out what to do, make mistakes, struggle, do good things, get sacked, come back. So it's very much on those individuals, and the war is a sort of is out there, but it's not a focus. I mean, there's so many fantastic books to read if you're interested in, you know, the story of a, you know, an individual battalion, or, you know, what it was like to serve on the Western Front.
So I guess it's fair to say you concentrate on why things happened rather than how things happen necessarily. I think the kind of political insight is one of the strengths of the book. I guess the avoidance of getting bogged down in kind of tactical discussions is maybe an essential product of having so much to cover.
Yeah, you've got to make choices, and I think, you know, I have elements of that in, but it's not a major. Well, it's a theme of the book, but it's not something that I can really get bogged down into too much. So, you know, each chapter's about sort of 2 to 3 months. Some chapters are shorter. 1914 is difficult to write because so much happens so quickly. So you have to have more chapters there. But essentially, then once you get into the trench deadlock, it sort of becomes easier to write because it's more regulated. So you can have your chapters every, and so you can sort of flow it like that, really. And that was one of the themes I wanted to do, was just to keep that going. So that was a kind of crucial consideration in terms of actual, you know, what could be covered, what couldn't be covered, just to try and keep the flow going, really.
One thing that really interests me, you've already mentioned that this is sort of something that looks at the higher level of the Western Front. And the first thing people like to do, or definitely that laymen like to do, is start thinking about it in terms of heroes and villains in the First World War. You give a lot of credit to people like Lossberg and Petain, for example. Do you still, in 2020, when you write this book, see any villains or butchers in the old style of the 70s, 80s?
Not really. I mean, there are maybe the odd one, you know, the odd one or two that aren't really particularly competent, but I don't see many of them in that sense. I think some of them make more mistakes than others. Some of them are able to recover. Some of them are good at certain periods of the war and then not very good in other periods of the war. So I just think you have to see the whole thing and see the enormous challenges that they try to deal with. And, you know, I think if we were to redo this today, I think you'd see a very similar thing. Some people would rise to the top very quickly because they have the character and the intelligence. Other people would be okay at it. Other people would be not so good at it. So I think you've got, I mean, there are certain instances, there are certain, you know, periods where people make big mistakes. You know, General Nivelle in the French army makes a series of major errors. And I really wanted to like Nivelle. And I'd love to read a modern biography of him, a proper, detailed, big biography.
I just can't find it in myself. I can't find enough to like him. I don't know about you, but it's like, yeah. I know the intentions are good and everything, but I can't get past the arrogance.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to know more about him. I mean, there is, I think there's a couple of biographies, but they're not particularly good, I think. So I was using what I could, but I'd love to find out more of him. And I liked him, but he makes an enormous series of errors. And, you know, again, with Haig, you know, 1st of July is and the Passchendaele campaign are always, you know, the two things that I think prevent Haig's, you know, the argument about Haig always gets stuck on them, really, because I think they reveal weaknesses. So there are generals that make mistakes, but it's not, you know, it's not sort of the butchers and bunglers in the old way. I think a lot of them are, the problem is that they're too often caricatured and seen as the sort of, cardboard cutout figures. And you look at the photographs and the mustaches, and they just don't seem real people. So I really wanted to humanize them, really, and, you know, trying to find anecdotes and descriptions of them was a real challenge and was something I really, really looked for. It's harder for the German generals. It's very difficult. You find, you know, you can find them maybe from Ludendorff, Hindenburg, but for this, even for army group level commanders, you know, we've got Jonathan Boff's book on Ruprecht, but pretty much everyone else is very difficult to find their stories or their descriptions of what they're trying to do. So searching for anecdotes to try and humanize them and to bring them a bit into to the light was something I really wanted to do, and it's challenging. It's even more challenging for the Eastern Front, but we'll not get into that now.
Just because he is the flashpoint of a lot of people, what do you make of Gough? My assumption, I think Lockie probably broadly agrees, is 17 bad, 18 not his fault.
I'd probably say it's 15 bad, 16 bad, 17 bad, 18. Yeah, I mean, he does pretty good, I think, in 18. I don't think you can criticise him too much for 18. Yeah, I think he's just overpromoted, really. I think he's just overpromoted and ultimately doesn't really ever feel he has control or a grip of a battle in a way that some other commanders do. I think he would have probably been quite a good divisional or corps commander, but I just think he's overpromoted. And that's, you know, he doesn't really ever get, I, in a sense, I can feel sorry for him a bit in 1917, certainly at Passchendaele, because he doesn't really want to fight at Ypres. He doesn't know the ground. But ultimately doesn't really, he's not really able to construct a battle plan that works, unlike, you know, Plumer.
I'll speak in defence of Gough for a moment. I don't know if it's in defence of Gough or not. I mean, you know, I've sort of found elements of my research where he's quite proactive in terms of training, you know, getting his weaker divisions working alongside stronger divisions. For example, 61st Division comes into his army area in late 1916, and he immediately puts them alongside 18th Division and has their officers going off and watching 18th Division in their kind of attack practices, and 62nd Division shifts their style of attacking accordingly. So, I mean, there's certain things that he takes seriously. I think by the end of spring 1917, he was probably the only British Army commander who had done something, really. You know, his armies had kick-started the advance to the Hindenburg line and pursued the German army very hard all the way up to it. So, I don't know. Did Haig really have much of a choice in terms of who he put the kind of the main offensive through Flanders too, given that Plumer hadn't had his success at Messines Ridge by the time he'd lost the Bluff the previous year and nearly got sacked because of that and didn't.
I think
really
if you're Haig, it's easy to see why Haig sat there and thought this is the one, the proactive one that's going to punch through and get stuff done.
He loved Johnny Gough as well.
Oh, poor Johnny Gough. He was the great one that never was. That ricochet bullet, I think, robbed the British Army of something really quite special that would have made mistakes as well, because it was a learning curve. But I think he was better than his brother.
Anyway, but we never would have known, because we never got an army to command.
I think with
he almost got a division, didn't he?
I think with 1917 and Gough, I think there are alternative commanders. You know, I think the problem is that the other commanders aren't giving Haig what he wants, which is a breakthrough. They're saying, you know, we need to be a bit more cautious. And so he, you know, Plumer and Rawlinson are both cautious, more cautious individuals. And so so Haig goes for the individual who's more optimistic. And I mean, that's the reasoning I understand from Haig. I just find that reasoning strange in mid-1917. Given what has just happened with the Nivelle offensive, trying to break through, the fact that you could then break through is for me a major flaw in Haig's reasoning. But you know, that's another book.
Why do you think Haig is so compliant with regards to the Nivelle offensive?
Well, I suppose he has to be, because you've obviously had the Calais conference, you had like David Lloyd George weighing in. David Lloyd George making it clear that he wants the French to lead this part, and he wants Haig to acquiesce within it. So it doesn't come about easily. Haig makes it clear that he does not like being under Nivelle. So does Robertson. So there's a huge political scandal. So, you know, Haig does his duty in sort of the spring of 1917 by supporting the French, but he's not happy about it, and makes it very clear that, you know, David Lloyd George has essentially broken the relationship with him and the army more generally. So Haig has to be, but it's not. By the time you get to May, Haig's getting itchy, and as soon as Nivelle's star begins to wane, Haig is saying, okay, then I've supported you, now you need to support me.
With sources, when you're writing something like this, I always find that I find someone that I particularly love, as when I was doing the George Fist stuff at the Royal Archives, it was Rawley, because my God, his letters were good that he sent to the Royal Household. What sources ended up being your go-to sources? Who did you really connect with when you were writing this?
I don't know. That's a great question. I think the problem is I've got quite a lot of individuals. So it's, you know, you move through individuals quite a lot. You get some fantastic descriptions here and there. You get some very good generals that write, you know, some fantastic stuff. I think some of the French stuff is good. Some of the reports Pétain writes are very clean and clear, and you can see the intellect behind it. Someone like Charles Mangin as well. Some of his letters are very punchy and aggressive, as you'd expect. So I enjoyed doing him. You know, someone like George von der Marwitz, the German Second Army commander in 1918, writes a diary, and his descriptions are really, you know, beautifully written and really evocative of the period. So you occasionally run across some very interesting individuals that haven't had, you know, any attention really that you could do that. So I think there were a few people in the book that you find these descriptions of that are quite nice. And of course, never been translated into English before. So, I think he was good. I liked some of Petain's reports. I find that them quite illuminating. Who else? There's a few, you know, there's a few sort of lower down the chain of command that occasionally writes, you know, a beautiful letter or a beautiful report that you just think is wonderful. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we obviously has already been published and, you know, has to be in there. But there's also stuff that you find that, you know, has never been published before. So I like to put that stuff in really. But I remember George von der Marwitz's letters and diary entries were very interesting. Some of Nivelle's stuff is quite interesting. Petain's good. Yeah.
Staying with the theme of research then, and also kind of progress, I guess. I mean, my own research is structured around the British Army's progress. And I think part of the kick against the old Blackadder and Butchers and Bunglers view is the idea that progress was steadily being made. And particularly with an Anglophone audience, we talk about the BEF and the British Army. That's not necessarily a ball that you picked up and run with in the book. Where do you stand on the British Army's progress? How did it get better, if indeed it did?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it gets better. There's no question about that. You know, I think it's pretty obvious to see the changes that it goes through, the technology and the innovation, the tactical innovation, the use of air power, armour, artillery. Again, that's been well established and I've gone with that. I think with the book, it's all about the innovation of all the other armies as well. And I think that's, you know, so it's looking at a lot of the innovations the French do. And then, you know, obviously the German counter. But I think, you know, if you look at all of the armies on the Western Front, who innovates the most, who innovates the best? I think this is a really interesting question. I think certainly in the early years, 14 to 16, I think the French, you would have to say the French really innovate significantly in terms of offensive tactics. But I think by the second half of the war, I think you've got to give the credit to the British, because I think some of the stuff the British are doing in 1918, the integration of sort of combined arms stuff, the integration with air power and tanks, I think is state-of-the-art stuff, and no one else is really doing it. So I think the French sort of peak really in 17, I think, in their development, and then it just sort of peters off in 1918, really. Do a lot of fighting, but it's not really. Whereas a lot of the innovations then come with the British. So I would, you know, and again, the British start from a very small, you know, from a very small army. So I think you've got to give the British credit, really, when you look at it in the wider context.
You've mentioned the Americans already, and you do cover them, and there's a tendency with us in Anglophone and even European-centric ones is to just sort of tap them on the end because they arrived late and that. But what is the significance of the Americans on the Western Front?
Oh, it's crucial. The Americans allow the victory. The Allies can't win without the Americans. I believe that very strongly. The problem I had this conversation with an American professor. He says, well, there's not enough Americans in the book. And I said, well, yeah, but if you're writing chapters that are about 2 or 3 months each, how many chapters can I include the American operations in 1918 in? 2 chapters? 3 chapters? You know, if we second Marne. And so the problem is they do arrive in strength very, very late, but the fact that the Americans are involved and serious is a crucial configuration. First of all, it forces the Germans to attack in 1918, and it provides a crucial morale boost for the Allies when they're really low in 1917. And then it does provide that kind of real momentum in 1918 that allows the Allied attacks to really punch home. So without the Americans, the Allies can't win.
So I run I'm a course tutor with an organisation called the Brilliant Club, and I get my students, they're sort of GCSE age, to write an essay at the end of the course on why did the Germans surrender in November 1918. Can I say the Western Front was the key deciding factor?
Yeah, they're defeated on the Western Front. They can't hold. that's where their armies are broken. So that defines everything else. It's where the war is won and lost. You know, the Germans can win in or against Russia. They can conquer the Balkans, but ultimately they can't hold on in the West. And that's what breaks their army and causes a revolution and forces the abdication of the Kaiser. So the Western Front is the decisive theatre of the war in terms of the big issues of whether Germany can survive or not.
We've got to the part where we sell your book to people. So why should people go out and buy your book? If they're looking at a whole shelf of World War One in Waterstones, why does yours stand out?
Well, again, it includes all of the, you know, all of the combatants. So you don't just get one side, you get the whole side. You get a closely written narrative of the war. So you follow the generals and the politicians through the whole thing. So you see how it rises and falls, and you see people come back and people get sacked, and you see that whole story of the characters. So I don't think it's really unlike anything else. It's narrative history in the grand scale. That's what I wanted to do, it in the grand style of narrative history. So if you like a story, then there's plenty of stories there.
Nick, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about your new book. I know that Boney will put it on the link with this episode for people to go and buy from our bookshop page. The Western Front by Nick Lloyd. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick. Thank you so much.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Elena and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.